Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be in Proverbs 14 today. I want to take just a minute to give you a few clues for interpreting this kind of passage. It's like the rabbis call this pearls on a string. It's little short, pithy sayings or maxims that are not connected in any kind of overall pattern. Now, we can see certain themes to the book of Proverbs, and I want to tell you a real good way to interpret Proverbs is by themes, to find the family, to find friends, to find the tongue, to find the godly wife. Those kind of theme patterns are much better than trying to just go chapter by chapter through Proverbs, because it's so hard to outline and so fluid in its content. So themes are a good way. And another way I want to mention to you is to read several translations. And as you note the differences, you will note that there is a problem either in the etymology of Hebrew words or the syntax of the little maxim. And so it's going to be real important to read several different English translations of the Proverbs. And I want to show you a couple that I've brought. I think sometimes we forget that very ancient translations are available to us. This is my copy of the Septuagint. Now, it's the Greek translation of the Old Testament. It's one page is Greek and one page is English. But this is very helpful because it really gives a manuscript variation to the Proverbs. Another one that you can buy in English, this is from Lampsa, and it is the Peshitta, known as the Syriac translation, around 4th century A.D., but it's available in English, both Old Testament and New. And this will be very helpful. If you have a Revised Standard Version, that's an awful good comparative manuscript, because it often has marginal notes or manuscript variation included. The New English Bible does the same thing. It tries to upgrade the etymology based on the latest archaeological discoveries from Ugaritic, Nag Hammadi, and all of those. A very good translation that I use quite often, I use the New American Standard to preach and teach out of the Old Testament, but the American Standard Version of 1901 is a very good study Bible because it's so literal. It's so wooden in its translation of the Greek and Hebrew that it's not a flowing English translation, but for a study Bible, it's just excellent. A new Catholic Bible out called the New Jerusalem Bible is a very good one. So I hope you'll find these, read through several of them, and see how the text changes in its interpretation and translation, and you'll get a real clue. Now I want to mention two commentaries that I like very much. This is the one I recommend to you on Proverbs. This is the Tyndale Old Testament series. They're not complete yet, but this is Proverbs. It is an excellent, excellent commentary. I trust all of these, put out by InterVarsity Press, Tyndale Old Testament series. Now, if you're not familiar with the Anchor Bible, it is a very textual-oriented commentary. Matter of fact, it's going to be too involved for the vast majority of you, but for those of you who really know something of Hebrew, this is going to be a good linguistic tool. And so I hope you'll notice those two. Let's go to the text itself. The wise woman builds her house, but the foolish tears it down with her own hands. Now, several times throughout Proverbs, we have talked about, first of all, how lucky a man is to have a godly wife. It's more valuable than gold or rubies or diamonds. Now, this emphasis here is how the woman has a very prominent place in the orderliness and the calmness and the functioning of a Jewish home. I want to give you a couple of other references. You might want to see chapter 18:22 and 19:14. Now, of course, all of Proverbs 31 talks about a godly woman and how she helps her husband in many ways, and you might want to notice that. Verse 2, "He who walks in his uprightness fears the Lord, but he who is crooked in his ways despises him." Now, this fear of the Lord is a major theme of the book of Proverbs. And you've got to remember that whenever it talks about wisdom, it's talking about a man who fears the Lord. Going back to chapter 1, verse 7, or chapter 15, 33, the beginning of wisdom is reverence for the Lord. And so whenever wisdom is mentioned, it's connected with that personal relationship with God. And whenever wickedness is mentioned, like it is here, it's despising God. Now, you would think, if wisdom is related to God and wickedness is somehow not only sin against man, but sin against God. It is despising, rejecting Him. Now here's the little idea about crooked in his ways. Remember that all of the Hebrew words for righteousness, just, straight, come from the root that speaks of a measuring reed, a straight, we would call it a ruler or a straight edge. The measuring standard is God Himself. And so all sin is a perversion or a crookedness or a falling short, missing the mark of that standard. When the Bible says, be ye holy as God is holy, that's the standard. And so that's why all the Hebrew words for sin mean crooked, perverse, twisted, or falling short. Now, verse 3. In the mouth of the foolish is a rod for his back, but the lips of the wise will preserve him. Now, this word for his back is not in the Hebrew text. This is possibly related somehow to Isaiah chapter 11, verse 1. For the word rod here is only two uses of this Hebrew word in all of the Old Testament. Here and in that passage in Isaiah 11, 1 that talks about that he will come with a shoot from the tribe of Jesse or a little twig. Now that's the word here. Instead of a rod, one of them saying that a man will beat himself with his own lips. His speech will hurt himself. But I really think because of this Isaiah 11, 1 passage, that what it's saying is that a man, as a man speaks, he will truly reveal his heart. You know, Jesus said it's out of a man's heart that he is corrupted. And this is saying the same thing, I think. The more you hear someone talk, the more you'll know who they truly are. And that's what I think is here. You might want to see chapter 10, verse 13, chapter 26, verse 3. Okay, that's for the background of a rod for his back, but that's not the word here. Okay, let's get verse 4. I like this one. Where no oxen are, the manger is clean, but much increase comes by the strength of an ox. Now, I don't know about you. Have you ever met somebody? I have a friend who, we were over at their house one time having a birthday party for her little girl, and somebody dropped crumbs. And right in the middle of the party, she had to get out the vacuum cleaner and vacuum the carpet. Now, do you know anybody like that? The kind of person that goes around and wipes under your hand when you're eating. You know, so meticulously clean, a perfectionist. Well, you know, sometimes cleanliness means absence of anything really happening. The commentary I recommended to you, the Old Testament, Tyndale Old Testament, has entitled this, Neat But Negative. The fact that the ox is there and he will help you produce what you need to feed the ox and yourself means the stable is going to be dirty. It's kind of like with kids. When there's kids in the house, the place is going to be a wreck. And to try to want it completely clean would probably have to mean get rid of the kids. Well, that's the idea here, I think. Now, others think it means that you've got to take care of the oxen and he'll take care of you in the production that he does. Now, I think number one is probably it, though number two is a possibility. Listen, number five. A faithful witness will not lie, but a false witness speaks lies. Now, in the Old Testament, two witnesses to confirm a matter. But you are really in bad shape if someone's willing to lie. That's what happened to Jesus. Many witnesses lied against him. That's what happened to Stephen. The witnesses lied against him. And this idea of a false witness is repeated over and over in the book of Proverbs. Chapter 6, verse 14. Chapter 12, verse 17. Chapter 14, 25, 19, 5, and 9. 24, 28, and 25, 18. So it's a common theme, this false witness. Now look at 6. A scoffer. And by the way, you might want to put 2 Timothy 3:7 for a scoffer. Always trying to find knowledge, but never seems to get there. A scoffer seeks wisdom, but finds none. But knowledge is easy to him who understands. True wisdom only comes from knowing God. And if you know God, you probably can't be a scoffer. The reason the scoffer wants wisdom is not so he'll understand God, but apparently he wants the social standing or the privileges are the acclaim that comes from having wisdom. And yet he apparently leaves out the relationship with God. Now here's the next one. Verse 7. Leave the presence of a fool, or you will not discern words of knowledge. I would just say, be careful the company you keep. I hear Christians all the time saying, well, I'm going to get in with that group and I'm going to witness to them and raise them up to my level. Well, I've lived long enough to know that usually is not what happens. It's usually just the opposite that happens. So be careful of who you have friends and company with. Now look at the next one. Let's see. Wisdom, the wisdom of the prudent is to understand his way. But the folly of fools is deceit. I think what it's saying here is, understand his way is the idea of putting life into a perspective with God. And that seems to be the idea. In verse 9, fools mock at sin. Now, the Hebrew here is the word guilt. Some say it means guilt offering. But I think the idea here is that since they don't know God, they don't recognize the sin in their own life. And they won't acknowledge it and won't deal with it in an appropriate way. But among the upright, there is goodwill or favor. And that's the idea that God is going to bless those who know him. Verse 10, the heart knows its own bitterness, and a stranger does not share its joy. Now, there may be something there about the isolation of all of us, the loneliness, the bitter loneliness, that really no one can really know us like we know ourselves and like God knows us. Now, we'll see verse 14 in chapter 9, verse 12. There is a loneliness and a bitterness about life that no one can understand, as well as a joy that no one can understand except God. Verse 11, the house of the wicked will be destroyed, but the tent of the upright will flourish. I've written the side of my Bible, sin bears the seeds of its own destruction. Now, there's pleasure in sin for a season, but there's death in sin over the long run. That's the idea here. Look at verse 12. There is a way which seems right to man, but its end is the way of death. That's a very popular proverb. It's repeated exactly in chapter 16, 25. And what does it mean? Well, it's either one of two things. A man thinks the road is straight. He thinks he's doing God's will, but it's a wrong way. But I don't think that's true, because I think if by faith we're seeking God's will, we're praying for his insight, we're asking him to protect us from the evil of our own heart, we want more than anything to do his will, whatever it is, I think he's going to guard us from that if we enter into it by sincere faith. He'll close the door. This seems to me to be the man who wants to get something for nothing. The man who wants to take what looks like the easy shortcut. And yet the shortcut always leads to death and destruction. Now, next one, verse 13. Even in laughter, the heart may be in pain, and the end of joy may be grief. Now, this is either saying that laughter is fleeting or that laughter holds no ultimate answers. And I think we could probably agree with that because of the fallenness of our world, that the bottom line of man's experience in our condition with our fallenness is frustration. And even though there are periods of joy, we're not looking for joy to answer ultimate questions or even to take away the bitterness of life. We're looking for a relationship with God. And I think that's what the idea here is. Verse 14, the backslider in heart will have his feel of his own ways, but a good man will be satisfied with his. I think real joy is only found in knowing the ways of God. And that's what this is saying. The naive believes everything, but the prudent man considers his step. And 16 is related to that. A wise man is cautious and turns away from evil, but a fool is arrogant and careless. You ever heard somebody say, don't believe everything you read? Well, we've got to be careful of who we listen to. We've got to be certain that the people we let influence us are godly people. People that know him and are following his ways. So don't be naive. Don't be a simpleton. Don't be gullible. No. It's the idea where Jesus said, I send you out as sheep among wolves. Be as cunning as a snake and as gentle as a dove. That's pretty good advice to handle our world. Let me continue then when it says, verse 17, a quick-tempered man is foolish, and a man of evil devices is hated. Now, you'll see when you look at some of these English translations how really different that proverb is translated. In my translation, what seems to imply is that a man with a bad temper, boy, he's hard to live with. But a manipulative, scheming, tricky person is even harder to live with. It's just hated and despised. Where a man with a bad temper, you just don't want to be around. This guy, you'll just really don't want to be associated with. That seems to be the idea here. Verse 18. The naive inherit folly, but the prudent are crowned with knowledge. And here again, throughout Proverbs, is this play between the fool and the wise man, or the naive and the man of understanding. Now, because of the whole context of Proverbs set in the wisdom literature, and because of chapter 1, verse 7, naive is the man who does not know God personally and does not seek God's will. And the man of wisdom and understanding is the man who does know God and does seek His will. So even though these are very practical things, there is a theological orientation. Okay? 19. The evil will bow down before the good and the wicked at the gates of the righteous. I think that's what saying is, that right and truth and godliness will ultimately overcome. Though in the short run, sometimes they don't. And that's the whole purpose of Psalm 73, reacting against the prosperity of the wicked. I think it's the book of Job reacting against why do the godly suffer. And I think, ladies and gentlemen, you and I know that sometimes the best die young. That's why an afterlife begin to develop in the sense of an understanding and a longing for a God of justice to really set it straight. It's not straight here. There's going to have to be another day, another place, another age. Okay? The poor is hated even by his neighbor, but those who love the rich are many. I think the central truth here is, be careful of false friends. Be careful of those who, even though they're your neighbor and you get in a hard time, won't help you. And really be careful of those who really like you as long as you've got lots of money and lots of things, but as soon as that's gone, they don't care anything for you. And then the next verse is connected with that, the ideal of neighbor, verse 21, when it says, he who despises his neighbor sins, but happy is the man who is gracious to the poor. Now, I think 20 and 21 relate together. It's the idea that God wants us to help the poor. Look down at verse 31. And that the book of Deuteronomy it continues to talk about the widow and the orphan and the alien and the needy. If we know God, we're going to be sensitive to the poor. We're going to have a heart of compassion. Remember that in Matthew 25, verses 31 and following, the great white throne judgment, the distinction between those who were saved and those who were lost is not the Lamb's Book of Life. That's Revelation chapter 20. But the distinction is, I was hungry and you fed me, and I was naked and you clothed me, and I was in prison and you visited me, and I was sick and you came unto me. And they said, when did we ever see you that way, Jesus? And he said, when you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. And so I think we need to really think about that. Look at verse 22. They will not go astray who devise evil, but kindness and truth will be those who devise good. I've written the corner of my margin, we reap what we sow. Now, that's true. You might well see the book of Galatians. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, that shall he reap. Galatians 6:10. That's what it's saying here. If we have laid down the seeds of evil and self and worldliness, a desire for riches, we're going to reap the pain of that. If we have set down a love for neighbor, a willingness to help the poor, a seeking God's wisdom and then applying it to our lives, a looking for that godly wife, that godly home, watching our speech, then we're going to reap the fruit of knowing God. Now, verse 23. In all labor there is profit, but more talk leads only to poverty. Now, the book of Ecclesiastes is quite a different book than Proverbs. It's looking at life on a human plane only. And it says that there's no value in work. But Proverbs is looking, now remember that Ecclesiastes is looking at life if there is no God and contrasting that to life with God. You might well see chapter 2, verses 24 through 27 is, there is benefit in labor. If God's in the equation, there's benefit. If God's not in the equation, there is no benefit in man's labor. Man's life is meaningless, and all that he does is fleeting and vanity and frail and will pass away. But if God's there, even the simple things of life, a man's work, the simple food, his home, the things that God provides for all men, there's going to be great joy in that because God is in the system. So people try to build the Protestant work ethic on this. I think labor is good. But I'm amazed in the modern America that over 80% of the people despise the job they have but feel like they have to keep it because of the money. That's a tragedy. There can only be joy in labor, first of all, when you know you're in the will of God, and second, when you do your labor as unto the Lord. And there's real joy there. Now, 24. The crown of the wise is riches, but the folly of the fools is foolishness. Now, you might want to see verse 22 connected with that, I think. And I have to add here, that we must remember that the book of Job is reacting against this oversimplistic view of life. If God loves you and you're following Him and you're doing the best you know, there's going to be riches. But if you sin, there's going to be disease and poverty. Well, that must be balanced with the book of Job and Psalm 73 and the reality of life that sometimes the good do die young. Now, look at verse 25. A truthful witness saves lives, but he who speaks lies is treacherous. Now, this is talking about a judicial verdict. When I was growing up, many folks tried to quote these, the wise man saves souls and on, as being something in a New Testament sense. This is a judicial phrase. It says that the man who is truthful is not going to give false testimony and therefore affect someone's life negatively. Now, 26 and 27 are related because little phrase, the fear of the Lord is mentioned. In the fear of the Lord, there is strong confidence, and his children will have a refuge. Now, what is this idea about his children? Is that God's children? Well, in my New American Standard, his is not capitalized. And I think really the phrase God's children is not a common phrase. Used in Deuteronomy some, but it's not common. I think here it's the man who trusts in God, who fears God. His children are going to take refuge in that man's faith. Do you mean that our children are affected by our faith? Oh, most definitely. And let me show you a couple of places. In the Ten Commandments, you know, it talks about, let me give you a quote there, Deuteronomy 5:9, that the sins of the father are visited unto the third and fourth generation. But if you'll look at Deuteronomy 7:9, but those who love God, the blessing are passed to a thousand generations to those who love him. Now, what does it mean that our children are somehow paid back for us? Well, you've got to bring in the individual responsibility of Ezekiel 18, which says that, no, everybody is going to stand before God for their own sins. And yet our parents and our friends and our culture does convey to us lifestyle priorities. They convey to us methods, and they convey to us lifestyle. And sometimes we really reap the whirlwind because of that. And that's what this is saying here, I think. Look at the next one. The fear of the Lord is a fountain of life. The one may avoid the snares of death. Now, some really wonder if verse 32 and verse 27 are talking about an afterlife. Or are they talking about a premature death? Well, it is true that there are not many passages in the Old Testament that talk about an afterlife. There are some in the Psalms. There are some in Job. And maybe there are a few in Proverbs like this one. But it's not really discussed much. I believe that the inferences in wisdom literature about that God is just and he's going to set it straight, that a real need for an afterlife, as well as the full truth that there is an afterlife, begin to develop in the heart of men who God inspired to write his truth. I really think here maybe it is talking about an afterlife. I can't be too dogmatic, but it seems to me that 27 and 32 are dealing with the idea of if God doesn't set it straight here, he will set it straight. Okay? Now, verse 28. In a multitude of people is a king's glory, but in the dearth of people is a prince's ruin. This just seems to be a simple proverb about, to be an effective leader, you've got to have a following, and you've got to have a number of people. And I think that's all it's talking about. Verse 29, he who is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who has quick tempers exalts folly. And here throughout the Proverbs, these characteristics of our personality are brought forth. And one of them that's brought forth over and over that could be a real good theme study is the idea of a quick-tempered man. Boy, it's just a real problem. And a quick temper shows lack of wisdom, or we'd put it in New Testament sense, self-control. Okay? Now, verse 30. A tranquil heart is life to the body, but passion is rottenness to the bones. Now, what does that mean? Well, here again, anger is seen as something that can even affect your physical life. If you'll look at 17:22, you'll see the same kind of inference. Do you mean that a root of bitterness or swelling anger in me will not only affect my spiritual life, which it certainly will, but will affect my physical life? Oh, yes. I think anger can destroy quicker than anything I know. It'll destroy a man's attitude. It'll destroy his body. Ulcers. And we're understanding more and more that cancer and diseases are quite often related to the attitude that we have about ourselves, about others, and about our world. And that a positive mental attitude is very, very crucial in continuing health. And that's what I think this is saying right here. Verse 31.
He who opposes the poor reproaches his maker, but he who is gracious to the needy honors him. Now notice, the way we treat men says something about our love for God. Now, that sounds so New Testament to me. There is a vertical relationship and there is a horizontal relationship, and they cannot be separated. You can't say, oh, how I love God, and treat your neighbor with contempt. Now, I think what this saying here, you might well see Job 31:15, where it seems to imply that in a real sense, all of us are brothers as far as being created by God and made in His image. Now, we're not all brothers until we respond spiritually to God's call in personal salvation. But we are all human beings made in God's image. Romans 14, that passage says, why would you destroy by your freedoms the man for whom Christ died, is the New Testament counterpart to this right here. We have got to realize that when we treat other human beings with either graciousness and love and provision, then in a real sense, we're doing that for God. Now again, I go back to Matthew 25, 31 through 46. How we treat others in Jesus' name says something about our love for God. I want you to think about that. Now, verse 32. The wicked is thrust down by his wrongdoing, but the righteous has a refuge when he dies. Now, this may be talking about the afterlife. I really think there may be something here to the view of Sheol being divided into two parts. Now, these two parts, the rabbis would say, one part would be paradise, and the other part would be Tartarus or Gehenna. So, therefore, we have this possibility of separation, and that may be the illusion here. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again same time, same place next week.